nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. This is the first lecture of the 501 series for this semester.
Wow.
And we are continuing actually from last semester, but we're a bit delayed. We are glad to have Professor Andrew Hirsch from the Physics Department. And the talk is on scientific ethics and the science of voodoo science. Please hold any questions you have until the end of the talk, because we are recording and it's going to be presented on NanoHub.
Well, I usually like to run these sort of in an interactive way, so I may pose some questions, if that's okay, to the audience during the talk.
Well, okay. Yeah.
So let me first understand who you are and what your backgrounds are. I know that some of you have a background in physics. The rest of you, I assume, are students in engineering. Is that true? And are any of you engaged in research at the moment? Most of you? Okay, good. So I hope this talk will be of interest. And what I want to discuss is the whole issue of scientific ethics. And I'll do this several different ways. I'll show you some information about what we know about scientific conduct within the science community. And I'll discuss some case studies that provide some an historic perspective. And I'll talk about what Robert Park calls the seven signs of voodoo science. And we'll talk about some very current, recent issues. So in 1987, the American Physical Society, that's APS, issued the following statement on integrity in physics. And at that point in time, the physics community was thinking very well of itself by comparison to other areas of research. And the statement said the following: the physics community has traditionally enjoyed a well-deserved reputation for maintenance of high ethical standards and integrity in its scientific activities. Indeed, the American Physical Society is one of the few professional societies which has not felt the need for a formal code of ethics. Well, if any of you know what transpired within the last 4 or 5 years in the physics community, you would say that this was a very short-sighted statement. And as I indicate here, the statement went on to exhort physicists not to take its good reputation for granted. But in fact, what has happened over the last 5 or 6 years is there have been some major episodes of what is undoubtedly scientific fraud within the physics community. And so one message is that no field of scientific endeavor should take this at all for granted. So let's talk about first, what is the scope of scientific ethics? What does it encompass? And it runs the gamut from outright fraud to what I would call grantsmanship. And I think we all have a feel for what fraud is, but perhaps not grantsmanship. So imagine that you're a new member of the faculty, an assistant professor in the College of Engineering at some well-known university, and you are about to write your first grant proposal to the Department of Energy, or perhaps it's the National Science Foundation. And grantsmanship means that perhaps you oversell your ideas. Perhaps you embellish some test studies that you've done in your laboratory in order to support, provide evidence for a much higher level of funding. So in part, researchers are always salespeople. They're trying to promote their ideas. And so grantsmanship simply means striking the right balance between being absolutely honest and level, and also yet at the same time trying to promote an idea that is perhaps yet unproven. And of course, negligence just means that not paying due diligence where it's required. Well, we can ask how serious is a problem are these various issues? And in fact, until recently, at least within the physics community, there was no quantitative measure. It's always been the assumption that if one makes a statement of a new discovery, that important falsehoods will be uncovered, because generally speaking, unbelievable claims require rock-solid evidence. And so we had the claim of cold fusion, room temperature fusion by Pons and Fleischmann some years ago. We'll talk more about that later. But such an extraordinary claim requires extraordinary evidence to support the statements. So things that go towards proving results wrong, of course, are the inability to reproduce results, a very important underlying principle of all science, reproducibility, and the fact that oftentimes insiders will disclose the truth of the matter. This has happened as well. So the Physics Today article in 2004 tried to quantify the degree of various transgressions, everything from data falsification, which is this little slice here, to inappropriate authorship on papers, that's a rather large piece of the pie, plagiarism, less than truthful reports, not citing prior work, delaying referee reports, again, inappropriate authors. Let me return to delaying referee reports so you understand how that happens. So as a member of the scientific community, we are often asked to review papers, and of course, we are sent papers in our own particular area of expertise. And because many scientific communities are not so large, the authors are usually known to us. They may even be competitors. And so this practice of delaying referee reports could be described as, well, taking your time in returning your review to the journal editor while you and your students are working on your competing analysis of perhaps a comparable data. And so you can see that this certainly does happen. So the people who were being interrogated here were the junior members of the American Physical Society who were responding to this survey. And so this is very, very enlightening and very troubling when you see data falsification. Another study, this was released in the journal Nature in 2005. They did a survey of some 3,000 National Institutes of Health-funded scientists. And they looked, they broke these down by early career people, mid-career, and everybody, and they look at the top 10 behaviors. And what you see is, you know, these are very small fractions of a percent. And then you reach number 7, where you start to see some larger numbers, failing to present data that contradicted one's own previous research. Across the board, very interesting, 5 to 6%. Overlooking others' use of flawed data or questionable interpretation of data, now we're above 10%. Changing the design, methodology, or result of a study in response to pressure from a funding source. This is very troubling to me personally, especially if you are relying on a new drug being developed and the scientific results are being influenced by the funding source. That report concluded that our evidence suggests that mundane, regular misbehaviors present greater threats to the scientific enterprise than those caused by high-profile misconduct cases such as fraud. I think it's easy to figure out why, because a high-profile case is going to draw a lot of attention. These other transgressions are down in the noise, and so, you know, they will go undetected to a large degree. So let's talk about what are the ethical standards of science. And certainly, if I asked you the question, you would probably pose this as the first solution, that honesty is the foundation of all science. The whole edifice of science collapses if there's not an honest exchange between scientists. If I report results, you have to believe, you have to trust that I am reporting faithfully what I did, how I did it, and what my measurements were. Only in that way can you go into the laboratory and replicate my results and confirm. It's an implicit social contract between scientists. It's implicit because we don't actually say this. Nobody ever said this to me during my scientific training. Somehow it somehow becomes apparent at some point, I think, to any thinking person, but it's seldom verbalized explicitly. So maybe today's the first time it's been verbalized for you. A good description is the following. Science is a set of rules that keeps the scientists from lying to each other. And those rules, though, are not often stated. So what are the characteristics? So now we know essentially the rules, but what are the characteristics of good scientists? Scientists should make judgment of truth in terms of intellectual criteria. There's an element of disinterestedness. That is, one should not be interested in promoting oneself, although admittedly we're all human beings and there's always some self-interest involved. But the thrust of one's scientific effort should be directed towards the extension of knowledge, wherever that leads. Good scientists are skeptical. One shouldn't accept results on the basis of authority. You shouldn't even accept your own results first time through. That is, if you run across a problem and you find a solution, this would be a scientific research problem that perhaps has significant implications, you have to be able to look very critically at what you've done and make sure that what you've done stands up to the closest scrutiny. I was involved in an experiment that was seeking to discover a particle that was predicted to exist, and my graduate student and I at the time thought we found evidence for it. And I remember one day up on the third floor of the physics building being very excited to the point where the sweat began to break on my brow. That was the level of excitement, because this would have been big news. Nobel Prize, no question. So we just sat on that for a while and looked at it very hard, and over a period of weeks we convinced ourselves that it was just an artifact. It was backgrounds had conspired to form a peak just in the location in the mass distribution where the prediction said it should be. The rule is you have to try to make the effect go away, and after you've exhausted everything possible, then perhaps it's real. One needs to be skeptical. And of course, there's the sharing of information with other scientists. Emotional neutrality. This is perhaps one of the hardest things to achieve, because again, we're humans. And maybe you haven't yet had this experience, but you will probably attend a scientific meeting at some point in your careers where researcher X is promoting one idea and researcher Y is in the audience, and there proceeds to be a discussion, my theory versus your theory, and it gets very elevated, my data versus your data, could be experimentalist. And emotions enter into the picture. This has happened throughout the course of, well, all human endeavor. But science, try as we might, we should make it as emotionally neutral as possible. But of course, egos get wrapped into things, and so that's a challenge, because we're all people. Now, there is a federal policy on research misconduct, and the policy is very clear. It identifies three different areas of misconduct. One is fabrication of data, simply making up results that were not obtained by any scientific procedure. Falsification of data, that means manipulating data so that what is reported isn't what really happened. And plagiarism, appropriation of another person's work. I would say that of the recent cases that have spilled into the public arena, these two first issues have been the problem. Now, so what happens then? How does one go about asking the question, was proper research procedure violated? Well, there has to be a significant departure from accepted practices of the relevant research community. And this last phrase is important because different research communities have different practices. There are different areas within physics that have their own rules for authorship, determining who's a lead author, who gets to be on the paper. Mathematics is different still. So there are differences within communities. Misconduct must have been committed intentionally. I'll discuss a case that really doesn't involve misconduct, but it's a good example of good science, wrong results, and nobody suffered career-wise. So misconduct must be intended with the intention of misleading. And the allegation must be proven by a preponderance of evidence. Now, a research one institution such as Purdue also has responsibilities. In fact, the federal agencies, they have the ultimate oversight when the research is funded by a federal agency, but a research institution such as Purdue bears the primary responsibility for prevention and detection of research misconduct and for the inquiry, investigation, and adjudication of research misconduct alleged to have occurred in association with their own institution. So every person at Purdue who oversees research at the graduate or undergraduate level has to adhere to these guidelines and is responsible. Now, I'm going to talk about some famous cases, and we'll go back and work up to the more recent cases. And some of these, you will say, well, that wasn't really misconduct. And some you may conclude was. So this is the famous NRAs. As you recall, in 1896 was the discovery of X-rays. And of course, that very quickly, X-rays became all the rage. People could view into beyond the our outer boundaries, could see bone structure. And so this set off a flurry of activity, people looking for other sorts of rays. And René Blondlot, who was a professor of science in France, announced the discovery of NRAs. These were different from X-rays. They were neutral radiation and apparently emitted by a hot platinum wire. And they had various effects. They were very difficult to detect. Remember, we didn't have modern detectors in those days. So there was a little flash of light on a screen across a room. And one of the interesting things is that NRAs could apparently be bent by a prism, but this was not an ordinary prism. This was an aluminum prism. And so there was an American physicist, R.W. Wood, who heard about this, and being the good scientist that he was very skeptical. So he went to France and contacted Blondlot and went into his laboratory and asked for a demonstration. And so in the darkened room, Blondlot showed him how this worked. And Wood asked that he please repeat the experiment. And in the darkness, Wood removed the prism, which was an essential part of the apparatus. And when Blondlot reported the same identical results, Well, that sort of sealed the case in Wood's mind. So he published an article in 1904 in Nature that killed the field. I mean, he said that this is just not good science. Now, you could argue that, well, this wasn't fraud, intentional fraud. It was perhaps deception, self-deception, because this was an effect at the very limits of visibility. Right? A little flash of light, imagined, real, perhaps. So one message I want you to take away is that when one is dealing with effects that are at the limit of detection, one has to be very careful. Low statistics experiments are particularly difficult. Doesn't mean they're always wrong. It just means one has to take great care. The irony is that in spite of this publication, the French Academy of Sciences still awarded Blondelot the Conti Prize, and they had a better candidate at the time in 1904. Because Pierre Curie had just won the 1903 Nobel Prize. So it didn't persuade those who awarded the Conti Prize. Now we go to the 20s and 30s. This is the myth of mitogenetic rays. This was reported by Alexander Gerwich, and these were apparently ultraviolet rays below 2,500 angstroms. These were emitted by healthy living tissue. And animals, plant cells when dividing. And they had an unusual property that they could be filtered by glass but not by quartz. And of course the flux of these quanta was always very low, always just below the limit of detectability. And so the experimental setup was as follows. Here's the live sample yeast in quartz, because the mitogenetic rays could pass through quartz. And here is a bacterial suspension and an identical bacterial suspension. This one's covered by glass, which would prevent the mitogenetic rays from being transferred to the bacterial suspension. And here is quartz, so this bacterial suspension could benefit by the mitogenetic rays. So the theory was that the rays were emitted here, could pass on to the bacterial suspension in the quartz container. Those would grow, these would not. Well, needless to say, all attempts to directly observe these UV rays failed. No matter how long one counted, no matter how sensitive the detector, they never could be seen directly, even with months of exposure. Finally, there was an editorial in Nature in 1931. The new experimental field failed to produce any evidence of mitogenetic rays. So here's an example of something that's, again, borderline detectable, and after years of trying, the signal, the experiments were unable to improve the signal to noise. So there was never any direct detection of this effect. And that's troubling. Usually, I'll give you a more recent example of an effect that was very marginal. Later, with better statistics, the situation became clear. Polywater. Now we're in the 1960s. And there was a report of the discovery of a water-like fluid formed during condensation of water vapor in quartz capillaries. And this so-called polywater had very unusual properties, a density 40% higher than that of normal water, a much lower freezing point, and the consistency of petroleum jelly. And so this really caused quite a stir because, well, it turns out that water does take different forms. And if you look at, when I say water in many different forms, that is ice, if you look at the different geometrical arrangements H2O can take it in solid form and even in liquid form, there are different forms of water. But this was a bit too unusual. So here was the experimental setup. Water was placed inside of a thin capillary, and then it was heated with a heating source, and then it was cooled over here. And so you started with pure water here, and you ended up with poly water here. Hundreds of papers published by 1971. But then the edifice began to collapse. It turned out that, try as people might, they had not taken sufficient care in the handling and the purity of the water. And ultimately, it was discovered that it was fatty contaminants in the original water and in the capillary that were responsible. Now, you ask yourself, was this fraud? What do you think? Yes? No? Probably a case of a scientific community not doing a very careful job in eliminating, until 1971, the possible causes of this effect. So this is, in my opinion, this I don't believe was fraud. There was no individual. I think other people were able to reproduce these results because fatty substances were these are found everywhere. So this is just difficult science made worse by poor procedure. Now we'll jump to something more recent. I think most of you are too young to remember. You know, you were probably I don't know, how old were you in 1989? You were young. Yeah, I remember coming home from work one day and hearing on the CBS Evening News an announcement that two chemists had discovered a means of producing room temperature, so-called cold fusion. And I remember Dan Rather explaining how this could solve all of our energy needs from here on out. And so, first of all, as a scientist, it was a little surprising to me to hear it announced on the CBS Evening News first. That's never a good sign. Right to the press. The claim was that there was excess heat leading in this chemical process, that is, more heat was given off, more energy was produced than went into the system. And so it was basically an inexhaustible source of power. And the two chemists who worked at the University of Utah, the University of Utah was very excited about this because they, of course, would patent this discovery and reap the financial benefits. 2 weeks before the press conference, a paper was submitted to the Journal of Electroanalytical Chemistry. It was published in 4 weeks. That's fast. Typical time is probably 6 months or more. A long list of errata soon followed, including the name of a co-author. Well, what happened, of course, is the physics community quickly tried to duplicate the experimental conditions. Information, concise and precise information, was very slow and forthcoming from Pons and Fleischmann. And actually, so many, many people rushed into laboratories, and there were many confirmations that were announced, followed by equally swift retractions. It turns out that it's not so easy to do what they tried to do in terms of carefully accounting for the energy balance, which is the critical point, the critical issue in this experiment. In 1989, there was a Department of Energy panel report after studying the whole process, and that report said no convincing evidence that useful sources of energy will result from the phenomena attributed to cold fusion. will arise. The University of Utah's handling of cold fusion is a striking illustration of what happens when scientists circumvent the normal peer review process, when scientists use the press to disseminate information about a claimed discovery in an unrealistic and overly optimistic tone. And it goes on. What happened in this case is that the financial rewards were so mind-bogglingly great. The University of Utah put tremendous pressure on the two chemists that made this purported discovery to go public. I don't mean to say that the University of Utah is the sole source of the problem here, but they certainly were very aggressive in getting this announcement out to the world. When the data are published by private communications rather than those responsible, when administrators use potential royalties to force premature publication, and when university administrators lobby for large federal funds, as was done in Utah, before the science is confirmed, problems arise. Okay, so I've given you some what I would call historic examples, and so now I want to talk about what Robert Park, who is a physicist who writes for the American Physical Society, the seven signs of voodoo science. And I think these are just good guidelines to keep in mind so that you can recognize when something may not seem right. And I think you'll probably know these intuitively. A discovery is pitched directly to the media. Okay, we just talked about one. A powerful establishment is said to be suppressing the discovery. Well, in the cold fusion episode, Pons and Fleischmann were both chemists, and as more and more physicists attempted to replicate their results and came up with null results, their claim was that the physicists were responsible for negative reports, that it was the physics establishment that was against this discovery. An effect is always at the very limit of detection. Well, I gave you the one example of René Blondlot. Very difficult experiment. Another example, this is ongoing, is what Robert Park calls parapsychology, paranormal effects. For all the years of people studying parapsychology, the signal has never gotten stronger. And so this is a very difficult issue and that is trying to measure something that where the signal to noise isn't favorable. The luckiest thing in the world is for you to attempt a measurement where the signal to noise is huge. There was a very famous experiment by Sam Ting, who in the 1970s discovered the particle known as the J-psi particle. This particle opened up a whole new realm of physics. And he was fortunate because it was hard to find, but when he found it, the signal was huge. There was no mistaking that this was something new and was real. But oftentimes, nature is not kind to us, and there are many fields of physics where the signal to noise is not favorable. And what that says to me is, as a scientist, you have to be very educated in the use of statistical analyses, and you have to really understand what background processes contribute to the thing that you're measuring, because you measure noise plus signal. And so sometimes nature isn't kind. So it isn't to say that every time there's a small signal to noise, it's wrong. It means you must take great care. Evidence for discovery is anecdotal. And what Robert Park, his statement is the greatest discovery or breakthrough in science was the randomized double-blind test. It's the most important discovery in modern medicine, because there is, of course, a lot of folklore, some of which might be true, but the only way to determine the truth is through a double-blind test. And so anecdotal evidence is not sufficient. That's the message. A belief is said to be credible because it has endured for centuries. And statement is science is conditional. Right? Galilean relativity was certainly credible for many centuries until we discovered some inconsistencies and Einstein's theory of special relativity replaced it. So science, and this is something I think that the general public doesn't understand, that science isn't static, right? Today's truth can be rewritten. If I can show you textbooks that say the neutrino is a massless particle. Not anymore, right? That was rewritten in the not-too-distant past. And so textbooks need to be rewritten as new science becomes established. An important discovery is made in isolation. Well, back to Pons and Fleischmann. Soon thereafter, a gentleman who was a Harvard MD claimed that he could also perform cold fusion, but the process was entirely different. What he claimed was these were really, the energy was released because he had discovered a new ground state, a lower ground state of the hydrogen atom. Think about that. And he started a public company, Black Light Power. If you go to Google and put that in, you'll go to his website. Now, just so you don't think I'm making this up, this is an article from the Monday, January 9th, 2006, Wall Street Journal. And it says, energy play draws money and ire. Firm claims a power source is worthy of big backing. Physicists say it can't work. So this is a company run out of Cranberry, New Jersey, run by medical doctor Randall Mills, who claims to have discovered what he calls hydrinos, a previously unknown form of hydrogen in which electrons move to a lower ground state of energy than previously thought possible, but still manage to kick off power. Dr. Mills says his discovery will end the reliance on fossil fuels and even replace fire. But hydrinos, as described by Dr. Mills, violate the law of quantum physics. Yet some financial, business, and even notable names from the military community have given black light nearly $50 million. $50 million. Dr. Mills counters that Mr. Park, Robert Park, our friend of voodoo science, represents an entrenched physics establishment that fears losing billions in academic funding and having its work discredited. Okay, so let's go back. That was the powerful establishment. So it's right by the textbook. Anyway, so you see these things, they didn't just exist years ago. They're going on now. Okay, so let me talk about a couple of more recent cases. This first one is anomalons. So this occurred in the 1980s, and basically the situation is the following. Scientists, physicists, would take a beam of say gold and accelerate it and have it collide with the atoms, the nuclei, in what's called a nuclear emulsion, basically film. And you know, film is there's silver atoms in film and some other iodine atoms, some other species, and they would follow. In these nuclear emulsions, the beauty of the nuclear emulsion is it makes a physical track, and so you can visually inspect and see the reaction products. The downside is you have to do it more or less by eye, by hand. So it's difficult to process a lot of data. Okay, it's not like a modern detector. So at the time, so this is a rather old technology that was used in the 20s and 30s. But nonetheless, the point of these particular experiments was to have a first collision of the gold nucleus and then to follow the interactions of the subsequent products. And what the scientists discovered was that those subsequent interactions occurred in a much shorter distance than would have been expected, than was expected. So technically, the way to say that is, there was a shorter mean-free path for the reaction products to undergo another interaction. And so the nuclear theorists and the experimental community all got very excited. And the picture that arose was that these were anomalous nuclei, therefore anomalons, and it was as if they were large for the number of nucleons. And so they had a picture that somehow there had been a hole blown through the center of the nucleus, and they had been geometrically enlarged now. It's sort of swollen and presented a larger cross-section and therefore would interact more frequently than normal nuclei. And so I remember attending a conference at Berkeley. It was an international conference talking about anomalons. And it wasn't just one group who had seen this effect. A couple of groups had seen the effect. And people went away, and a couple of years later, I had a colleague who was a graduate student at the time, actually did his thesis work on anomalons. What transpired over a period of a couple of years is people, of course, got more accelerator time to do the experiments, improve the statistics, and as the statistics improved, the effect got smaller. So this is an example. Nobody committed fraud. People were very excited over the possibility, but again, it was an effect involving small statistics, low statistics. And the moral of the story is, one can be fooled. So it's a dangerous game, but sometimes that's the way it is. The 17 keV neutrino. So I had already alluded to the fact that now the textbooks will say neutrinos have a rest mass. This announcement preceded what the current state of knowledge regarding the neutrino and its rest mass. So this was an experiment that was done. It was done by a group of physicists, and it was a very clever experiment. In a nutshell, they built an experiment in which the radioactive decay that gave rise to the neutrino was done inside the detector itself. So if you think about normal decay detection, you have a nucleus over here that decays, emits one or more particles, which are then detected in a separate detector. The beauty of this experiment was the decay took place inside the detector itself. And they produced a series of physical review letters. Again, a conference was called. It was at a Michigan State Division of Nuclear Physics meeting in the 1980s, standing room only audience, because this was very exciting. People had been looking for years for evidence of a neutrino rest mass, and they gave a beautiful presentation. On the other hand, there were other physicists who tried to measure. I mean, if the neutrino has a rest mass, it shouldn't matter how you measure it. So there were other experimental methods that were designed to also measure the neutrino rest mass, and they always came up with zero. Some years later, a couple of years later, the group that made this discovery undiscovered it because they finally understood the source of their error. And this was an honest error. It was a subtle artifact of their experimental apparatus involving multiple scattering. And in the end, the physics community accepted their explanation, and nobody's reputation was damaged. These were all hardworking, honest scientists who made full disclosure at every step of the way. They did a difficult experiment, had a complicated apparatus, didn't fully understand it because of the subtleties, but ultimately got to the truth. So here's an example of, I wouldn't say poor science, I would say difficult science, but the manner in which it was handled with the scientific community left everybody's reputations intact. At Lawrence Berkeley Lab, a couple of years ago, there was an announcement of some super heavy elements having been discovered. And these are elements heavier than uranium, mass, or proton number 118 is one example. And there was a group of scientists who had discovered, so let me back up one moment. Nuclear theory predicts that there are some super heavy elements that can be formed. These are not stable. So you bring together the right number of neutrons and protons, and there's a system that exists for maybe a millisecond, but it exists for a short period of time. So there were some very specific predictions made by the theoretical community, and so this particular group set about to try to make them at the LVL cyclotron. And some, in fact, were discovered. And in particular, element 118 was discovered. And one thing led to another, and it turned out that the person who was responsible for within the experimental team, one person was doing the analysis. And nobody could check his work, so people took it on faith. And after an internal investigation, because other competing groups were having difficulty replicating the results, there was a clear path of fraud involved here, where data was massaged inappropriately. Now, what's ironic is I've talked about this now for several years, but there was just now an announcement about the discovery of element 118 by I think it's a German group, and it was, if you look in the science column of today's New York Times, you'll see the announcement, and it makes an explicit reference to this earlier fiasco where the discovery, quote, discovery sort of jumped the gun in terms of announcing a true discovery. So the scientific community now, particularly when it comes to heavy elements announcements, is very sensitive to this issue. But one of the lessons here is you had one member of a team who alone was the only person who could do the analysis. The way the fraud was discovered is a senior member of the team finally taught himself enough about the analysis program so that he was able to do it himself. And when he did it, he discovered that, you know, the raw data just did not show that the element was there. So the moral of the story is when one researcher goes off and comes back and say, hey, I found the Higgs boson or whatever it is, one has to be very careful. And probably the most recent and publicized case is that of Lucent Technology. So I'll spend just a few minutes talking about this because this is... I think of all the cases, this is the one that rocked the physics world. This was a series of announcements by a research team at Lucent, formerly known as Bell Laboratories, which within the scientific community had undoubtedly the highest reputation in terms of industrial research laboratories. When AT&T was broken into pieces, the Bell Labs remained their crowning jewel of science. And so the Hendrik Schön is the person who was investigated, And this was done in 2002. And this is a 129-page report, which I won't bother to go through in detail. But there are a couple of things that are noteworthy. So let me get the size where I want it. So there were three final allegations: substitution of data, unrealistic precision of data, results that contradict known physics. Now, what had happened is out of Hendrik Schön's lab came a series of very earth-shaking papers to the scientific community. He was reporting results in materials that had heretofore never been suspected of being capable of showing the behaviors that he reported. What set the wheels in motion towards an investigation was the fact that he had a series of publications that were supposedly on different manufactured devices made in his laboratory that showed the identical same noise, different devices, different times. Now, we all know noise is random. We're talking about identical. And that raised some serious questions. So the conclusions can be summarized as follows. By all counts, Schön is a hardworking, productive scientist. If the valid the work he and co-authors report would represent a remarkable number of major breakthroughs in condensed matter physics and solid state devices. Okay. The most serious allegations regarding work in question relate to possible manipulation and misrepresentation. These allegations speak directly to the question of scientific misconduct. The committee carefully investigated each of these allegations and came to a specific conclusion in each case. The evidence that manipulation and misrepresentation of data occurred is compelling. In the mildest form, whole data sets were substituted to present different materials or devices. Schön acknowledges that data are incorrect in many of these instances. He states that these substitutions could have occurred by mistake. The recurrent nature of such mistakes suggests a deeper problem. At a minimum, he showed reckless disregard for the sanctity of data in the value system of science. His failure to retain primary data files compounds the problem. All the primary data files were destroyed. All the devices were destroyed. Intentionally, in the measurement process. More troublesome are the substitutions of single curves or even parts of single curves in multiple figures representing different materials or devices, and the use of mathematical functions to represent real data. Schön acknowledges these practices in many instances, but states that they were done to achieve a more convincing representation of behavior that was nonetheless observed. Such practices are completely unacceptable and represent scientific misconduct. One of the most troubling cases is that of superconductivity in polythiophene. Here, identical curves appear multiple times in whole or in part in a single figure. Schön acknowledges that these data are not valid, but cannot explain how they arose. Well, that's, you know, three of 120-some pages. What happened was Schön went off away from Bell Labs here, back to Germany where he had done his postdoc, did the experiments in the absence of all of his collaborators, came back and reported to his senior people at Bell Labs these results. Now, he was a perfectly reputable scientist as far as we know. He had excellent training, worked with excellent people, and it isn't to say that every publication that he had was fraudulent. I think there were some properly done and reported experiments. The problem is that things apparently escalated, and his senior colleagues didn't take the time to, in my opinion, to properly insert themselves. So nobody ever went with him to the laboratory in Germany to witness one of these measurements. Apparently, they didn't read the manuscripts very carefully because it was someone from outside of the immediate circle of collaborators that said, hey, these two noise curves are identical. How can that be? So I think they were a bit too trusting. Well, this really rocked the physics community. Unfortunately, Schoen, he was quickly relieved of his position at Lucent Laboratories, but it also called into question the journalistic practices of the journals that were so quick to publish this, and their editors didn't scrutinize things carefully enough either, apparently. So I would say of all of the cases in recent history, probably the Bell Labs case is the most spectacular, and a member of the Department of ECE was in fact on the examination committee that looked into this issue, Subrio Datta. So you have very good source of scientific misconduct, what it really means in terms of this particular case right here. So I've got more issues, but we can save that for another time. I've consumed an hour. So now I'd be happy to take any questions that you do have.
I'll ask you if you think it's reasonable that you can be forgiven. I mean, that is to say, as far as the government is concerned, say you kill somebody by accident, but it's still manslaughter. I mean, you're going to get convicted and put in jail.
I think it depends on intent. I think, at least within the scientific community, if you intentionally committed fraud once, I think there are very few scientists that would be willing to believe you in the future. Yeah, it really depends on intent.
Henry Kroll's case, institutional pressure, the thing that you also mentioned in University of Utah's case,
mm-hmm.
that could have been one of the factors, because at that time Lucent was going through a bad time, and the value of an industrial lab supported by a private corporation was being questioned. So they needed something very high profile. And under those cases, of course, when somebody, a young physicist, produces this beautiful results, then there is a propensity not to question or not look too hard at the papers.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we are all employees of Purdue University. And if I go into my lab, or you go into your lab, or you go into your lab and make some astounding discovery, you too will probably feel that pressure, and it's up to your colleagues, your mentors, and really it's up to this institution to resist those pressures. Often it's hard. In Utah, it really spun out of control. If you remember, the legislature in Utah committed millions of dollars to fund a fusion institute. I mean, they did this in like nothing flat after the announcement, and then as the scientific community weighed in with the evidence, that became a huge embarrassment to the state. So one has to be very careful when extraordinary things are discovered.
More questions, I think.
My pleasure.